Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's podcast of the week's best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulavi. This week, we've got a revealing interview with film and theater director Mike Nichols. He talks about his refugee childhood and making iconic hits like Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and The Graduate, and his marriage with Diane Sawyer. And we've got a look at the surprisingly fascinating history of the curtain call and some of the best ones on film. And one of our up-and-coming young reporters has a piece about stretching the truth in nonfiction literature. But first,
the film version of The Hunger Games comes out in a few weeks. It's based on the best-selling young adult novel of the same name, set in a dystopian post-apocalyptic world. The hype around the movie has pushed sales of The Hunger Games trilogy to new heights, and as NPR's Lynn Neary reports, publishers are eagerly churning out more novels with similar settings.
In the beginning, The Hunger Games was not considered a sure thing. Why would it be? It's the story of a world where teenagers are forced to fight each other to the death in a game that's broadcast and watched everywhere, like a reality TV show. David Levithan, editorial director at Scholastic, which publishes the books, says the company took a risk on The Hunger Games because they trusted the writer, Suzanne Collins. It wasn't until Collins turned in the first manuscript that Levithan understood what he had.
It came in on a Friday, and I and the other two editors working on it read it over the weekend, and then that Monday we just looked at each other and said, wow.
Now there are more than 26 million copies of all the Hunger Games books in print in the U.S., and all three books consistently top the bestseller lists. The film version of the book stars Jennifer Lawrence as Katniss, the courageous young heroine who volunteers to take part in the games in order to save her little sister from that fate.
Our tributes, Peter Mullark and Katniss Everdeen.
They just want a good show. That's all they want.
There's 24 of us, Gail. Only one comes out.
Dystopian fiction has been around for a long time, but the success of The Hunger Games has spawned a whole new crop of books set in a grim future where an authoritarian regime is just begging to be overthrown. These books are aimed straight at a teenage audience.
Dystopia is the new vampire, for sure.
Sarah Petrie is not a teenager, but she loves young adult fiction and writes about it on her website, Forever Young Adult. Look in the young adult section of any bookstore and you'll see shelves full of these books. Some of them even have covers that clearly imitate The Hunger Games. Petrie says there's always a hero or heroine, no older than the early 20s, faced with a life or death situation in a post-apocalyptic world.
You know, it's fun to see so many books try to guess how the world will end. I mean, there's supervolcano has been very popular, virus is very popular, nuclear bomb is very popular, but it is kind of fun to see writers trying to stretch and be like, what else could happen? What other terrible tragedy could occur?
It's kind of an alternate history of the United States in which love has actually been declared a contagious disease.
Lauren Oliver says she never intended to be part of a dystopian fiction trend. She just wanted to explore the idea of a society that views love as a disease and forces its citizens to be cured of it at the age of 18. Pandemonium, the second book in her trilogy, has just been released. Oliver says young people today can identify with the characters in these kinds of stories.
The young protagonists are inheriting this kind of dark and broken world, and with a little bit of pluck and courage have to navigate it and try to salvage some kind of happy ending. And I do think there's a lot of parallels to how young people kind of feel nowadays as they're confronting this future, which is very uncertain in this country economically, and they're inheriting what they see as kind of a broken world.
The best of these books, says Sarah Petrie, offer richly imagined visions of a world changed forever by a cataclysmic disaster. In Juliana Baggett's Pure, a massive bombing leaves survivors forever fused to whatever they were doing at the moment of the detonations. Petrie says it's a riveting device.
I loved how gross the mutations were in her book. She had a doll's head for her hand. She had the guy she likes has, like, birds in his back. It was really fascinating and gross. It's like a train wreck. You can't look away.
Rebellion plays a big role in these books, says Petrie, and it helps to have what she calls swoon, that is, a hot romance. Most are action-packed. Some, like the Chaos Walking trilogy by Patrick Ness, are violent.
If you think Suzanne Collins is mean in Hunger Games with all the people she kills, just wait till you meet Patrick Ness. I mean, he will make you cry. I cried so much reading all three books, but I found them to be absolutely amazing.
Not everyone is as big a fan of these books as Petrie. David Levithan, understandably, has a warm place in his heart for The Hunger Games, but he's not convinced that dystopian fiction will knock the vampire off its young adult perch.
I, as a reader, when I finish a dystopian novel, I just want to go read Pride and Prejudice. I feel that if you sat there and only read about broken worlds over and over again, I think it would get a little bleak and tiresome. So I'm not quite sure people are just reading this in the same way that they were like, oh, I'm just going to read vampire romance over and over again.
Of course, a dystopian world with vampires, that's another story. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
It's a scenario that's played out millions of times. Well, not exactly, but you get the idea. An author writes something that's supposed to be a true story. Then people figure out he stretched the truth. We all know how this ends on Oprah.
I feel duped, but more importantly, I feel that you betrayed millions of readers.
That's Oprah's famous takedown of author James Frye, who ran into trouble for making up much of his memoir, A Million Little Pieces. Now a new book is making waves by defending an author's right to embellish the facts. NPR's Travis Larchuk has more.
At first, this book, The Lifespan of a Fact, sounds like a writer's worst nightmare. It's an essay printed side by side with a fact check that tears the essay apart. Now, the essay has some history to it. 10 years ago, author John DeGatta was in Las Vegas when a 16-year-old boy committed suicide by jumping off the Stratosphere Tower. DeGatta wrote about his experience trying to figure out why this happened. And in the telling, he took a generous amount of artistic license.
All of which I was completely open about, but was unwilling to budge on. I, at the time, was too enamored, I guess, of my pretty sentences to alter them in any way.
Now, a journalist would probably be fired for trying to do something like this, but DeGatta says he isn't a journalist, and his goal was to create a more artistic essay. Even so, Harper's Magazine, which originally commissioned the piece, rejected it. The essay eventually found its way over to the magazine The Believer, where this guy, Jim Fingle, an intern at the time, was told to fact check it.
And, you know, maybe we'll call out the 10 things that are inaccurate, and it could be a little commentary on the essay.
So, Fingle got to fact checking, with no idea what he was really in for. Let's start with what he found in the essay's first sentence. Author John DeGatta will read from the essay and will stop and go to Fingle anytime there's a factual dispute.
On the same day in Las Vegas when 16-year-old Levi Presley jumped from the observation deck of the Stratosphere Hotel and Casino, lap dancing was temporarily banned by the city.
And stop.
Factual dispute.
That ban hadn't actually happened at that point.
So John's claim here isn't technically accurate.
All right, let's keep going.
Lap dancing was temporarily banned by the city in 34 licensed strip clubs in Vegas.
Stop again at that number, 34.
Not sure where John got this number from.
The author, John DeGatta, continues, listing more events that supposedly happened that same day.
And a woman from Mississippi beat a chicken named Ginger in a 35-minute-long game of tic-tac-toe.
And stop. Back to Jim.
This tic-tac-toe game actually happened a full month after Levi Presley's death.
Now remember, he was expecting to find maybe 10 fudged facts in the entire essay, and we're only through the first sentence.
It was interesting the sheer number of sources I needed to consult in order to break down a single sentence.
Sources like DeGatta's notes, a coroner's report, newspaper articles, websites, historical databases.
I had a lot of work ahead of me.
For an essay that was 15 pages, single-spaced, Fingle's fact check was more than 100 pages long. The book also includes correspondence from the process that shows author John DeGatta didn't take kindly to his fact checker at first.
Initially, I hated him. I was appalled. I was appalled and I was offended in the way that you get offended when someone points out that you're, you know, a big, ugly liar.
So I asked DeGatta, why did you make things up? Like that first sentence. You made it seem like all of these things happened on the same day from that first sentence.
Sure.
Why do that?
Because it's more dramatic.
Now, some of the reviews of this book mention that DeGatta basically comes off like a jerk. And before we go on, an essay about a teenage boy's suicide is a pretty touchy subject to use as the seed for this kind of discussion. So, to be fair, I called the boy's mother, Gail Presley. She says she loves DeGatta's work, especially that it brings attention to the issue of teen suicide. And to the people calling DeGatta a jerk?
If life gives you jerk, make jerk chicken.
So as far as the family is concerned, the people closest to this story are okay with it. And DeGatta's take?
I don't think it's okay for us to say, in your memoir about growing up and liking pie, it's completely okay to alter the facts. But when you're dealing with huge issues like suicide or nuclear waste or whatever, it's not okay. The subject in this essay is amped up to get us to pay attention.
DeGatta says the essay is an age-old art form, and the greater point is more important than the details. He paraphrases T.S. Eliot.
Sometimes we misplace wisdom for information. Accumulating all of this data isn't really going to provide us with the answer that we need. We need another approach, and perhaps that approach is one that's more meditative, one that isn't relying solely on gathering facts.
But still, when readers feel they've been lied to, they get angry.
It is important, and it's something that publishers think about all the time.
That's Jonathan Burnham. He's a senior vice president at HarperCollins. Now, he knows a thing or two about this. He actually gave James Frey a second chance after the Million Little Pieces scandal. And Burnham's also quick to point out that everyone's standards are different. Expectations change if you're reading a newspaper, a magazine, a literary journal, or a book.
But one of the most problematic issues that lies at the heart of all this is the sort of philosophical conundrum, what is the truth? Because the truth is often so subjective.
And Burnham says there's an easy way to get around this problem. Just start off with a disclaimer.
It's an almost essential piece of qualifying information that alerts the reader to the fact that not every single word in this book is true.
And there's some irony here. Because what isn't mentioned in The Lifespan of a Fact is that the book itself isn't all it appears to be. The correspondence between the author and fact-checker was largely invented just for this book, and much of the fact-checking, which Jim assures me is all real, was done specifically for this project. And I have to admit, when I found out, I felt like the rug was pulled out from under me. Again, here's author John DeGatta.
That, I firmly believe, is the job of art. And we can't have those experiences that, you know, break us open to something new if we are cued ahead of time.
The book is The Lifespan of a Fact. I'm Travis Larchuk, NPR News.
Yesterday, the director, Mike Nichols, stopped by our New York bureau to talk, or as he put it, to sell.
The producers want us to sell. That's my little joke. That's what we do by day. By night, we're artists.
The joke is that what Mike Nichols is selling these days is Death of a Salesman. He's directing the Arthur Miller classic with Philip Seymour Hoffman cast as Willie Loman. Mike Nichols says Death of a Salesman is about the central relationship of American life, fathers and sons, central to our culture, he says, and central to lots of movies, not necessarily his.
As I said in some interview last week, most of them with Robert Duvall.
Yes, yes.
Because it is our central relationship, more than in, I believe, any other culture.
This talk of fathers and sons leads quickly to questions about Nichols' own relationship with his father. Igor Nikolaevich Peshkovsky was a Russian Jew, a German-trained doctor, who got his family to New York to flee the Nazis. He took the name Nichols from his Russian patronymic. Once in the States, he sent Mike and his brother to live with a patient while he set up his practice. The elder Nichols' marriage was, by the son's account, one marked by discord and infidelity, and when Mike Nichols was just 12, his father died. It sounds like a very troubled father-son relationship, but Nichols says no.
Here's the thing. If you're fleeing Nazi Germany in 1939 and you're a Jew, you don't think so much about relationships.
Yeah.
People didn't have a lot of divorces during the Holocaust, for instance. And I never thought of it as anything but a great relationship.
But that's a tremendous pressure to think the dynamic within the family is
insignificant because we've got to figure out which continent we can survive on and whether we get out of this place on time. It's a pretty it's understandable. It's pretty constraining for a kid growing up.
Yeah. The thing about that is that if you're a kid, you don't know that much what's going on in the large world. Like when we landed in New York and my father was waiting for us and he came on board to get us and I looked across where the docks are, and on the land side was a delicatessen, and in its neon sign there were Hebrew letters. And I said, is that allowed? Mm-hmm. And my dad said, yes, it is here. That's my first memory. My next memory is of Rice Krispies and Coca-Cola because we'd never, ever had food that made noise before.
And here was a ritual, a symphony of food. That you
we were
have.
Very excited. Next came Chiclets, which I swallowed, of course. What else would you do? After a while, it was explained what it was for.
This is Mike Nichols. He can do serious, and he can do shtick. He went from the comedy duo of Mike Nichols and Elaine May to directing, both on stage and in the movies. What has he directed? Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Barefoot in the Park, The Graduate, Carnal Knowledge, Silkwood, The Birdcage, Working Girl, Closer, Spamalot, and the list goes on and on. At age 80, Nichols says he has used a gift that comes from being a little refugee kid who spoke only German, a kid whose whooping cough medication in Germany left him bald for life. He was the child who was different, the outsider.
The thing about being an outsider no matter what, because of some physical thing, that I didn't understand is that there's a good part, which is that it teaches you to hear what people are thinking, because you're constantly looking for the people who just don't give a damn. And, you know, these increase as you go through life. And because I learned to hear what people are thinking, quite literally, because I needed to, I think it stood me in good stead. It's probably why I'm in the theater, because I could hear an audience thinking when I was in front of them, which was a terrific advantage, A, in improvising because I knew where to go, and B, in confidence because you could make them like you. 1,000 people liking you and you hear it, it's not bad.
The cast that Mike Nichols is directing in Death of a Salesman isn't so bad either. He says they're also talented, Philip Seymour Hoffman and Andrew Garfield, Bill Camp, John Glover. It's like a joke. The show is still in previews. It opens next week. And I asked him, what's his job as director?
I think you find what's happening under the words, the story that is not in the words. You have to dig out the events beneath them. You have to find the events. And when you find the events, you have to make them clear through and in addition to the words that they speak. And plays, especially great plays, yield their secrets over a long period of time. You can't read it 3 times and say, okay, I got it. Yeah. I know what's happening. And that's the great excitement.
That, to me, that description of what you're doing right now, I'm trying to reconcile the act of directing with that and say, Spamalot, is it still the same thing even when the production is, its point is to be outrageously silly at every turn?
Absolutely.
Same thing.
Yeah. I did learn something very interesting on Spamalot. Namely, we got very close to New York. We were in Chicago for a long time working on it. And towards the end of the period in Chicago, I said, we do have to have some kind of story, just a rudimentary story.
Even there has to be something going on.
Yes. I was experienced in this. Because The Evening with Nichols and May, of course, didn't have a story. Right. It had individual sketches or scenes. Here's what I discovered. We put a story in the end. You know, that King Arthur, the Lady of the Lake, fell in love and lived happily ever after. We put it in sort of in the last 3 minutes. And by God, it was very moving. And it was a story.
Yeah.
You can do it in the very last few moments. And our need, our desire for a story is so powerful that it'll still work. If you're truthful in it, I used to say to the replacements, if you don't do this real as yourself, I'll come and beat the crap out of you. You have to
This
be,
works? This approach to actors works?
Yeah. Well, yeah. When they know a joke, when they hear it. And they have to really love each other and so on and so forth. And as soon as an audience recognizes that, they've laughed their ass off and they're perfectly happy. They have a story and it has a happy ending. And that's all of us who want nothing more. And it's pretty difficult to achieve without love. And love and its consummation is the ending of most happy stories.
Well, Mike Nichols, thank you very much for talking
Pleasure.
With us today.
Thanks for asking.
Mike Nichols, who is directing Death of a Salesman on Broadway.
If you're the kind of person who goes to the gym, you may have seen classes there for Zumba. It's not just a fitness craze. It's also an international business. You can buy Zumba CDs, a Zumba video game, and Zumba clothes. For a lot of students, it's their first taste of Latin music and dance steps. But Yowei Shaw reports that some Latin dancers are trying to make more of a distinction between their art and what happens in a Zumba class.
Lines of women in spandex flail around as the ground vibrates with the pulse of the music. There's body rolling, fist pumping, shimmying, and yes, even some full-on booty shaking. Damaris Diaz was lip-syncing the whole time. After class, she told me that she's Puerto Rican.
I love that all these different cultures are embracing the Latin culture now because of Zumba. You'll see people mouthing the words to a song, and afterwards, they'll come to me and they're like, Damaris, what does that mean? And I'll laugh and I'll say, but you were singing the song.
The story of Zumba begins with an accident that seems too good to be true. Back in the 90s in Colombia, Alberto Perez was teaching an aerobics class and he forgot his regular music. So he reached into his backpack and pulled out tapes of salsa and merengue. Fast forward to today, and Zumba has certified over 250,000 instructors. Each class uses salsa, cumbia, bachata, and other Latin and international rhythms. For some students, it's their introduction to Latin music. Marianne Martino Giosa straddles both the Zumba and Latin dance worlds.
Do they cross? Yes. Do we see clients that go from one class to the other? Absolutely.
Giosa is a semi-professional salsa dancer and teaches 19 Zumba classes a week in the Philadelphia area. She's got the six-pack to prove it. She says there are clear differences between the two. Like in Zumba, you start a salsa step on both the left and right foot. But in salsa,
it's a no-no to take that step on the right or break to the right in a salsa class. It's just not proper technique. With it being an exercise program in Zumba, obviously we have to exercise both legs.
But Giosa says there's still disagreement over whether Zumba is really Latin dance.
The salseros would tell you that Zumba is not Latin dancing. But anybody who takes Zumba does feel that it's part of Latin dancing because technically we are Latin dancing.
They are vaguely misinformed.
Jose Maldonado teaches Latin dance at La Luna, the same studio where Giosa leads Zumba classes.
One of my students said, I took Zumba. I think I know how to salsa dance. And I said, fine, strut your stuff. Let's see what you have. They couldn't salsa.
Perhaps what happened in yoga might be happening with Zumba and Latin dance. Joan White has taught the classical style of Iyengar yoga for almost 40 years. For her, yoga is a spiritual practice. White says it's not just physical fitness.
I find it extremely sad. It's like here is this wonderful tradition that comes from India, and now it's being completely overrun by people who have no idea what yoga is.
Authentic or not, Zumba has been good business for Latin dance. At La Luna, Zumba brings in as many, if not more, students a month as the rest of the studio's dance classes.
Ready, go!
World-ranked salsa dancer Darlin Garcia hopes to cash in on Zumba's popularity as well. His studio, Art in Motion, recently began offering Zumba classes, even though he still makes fun of it.
You're taking a salsa step, and in the middle of it, you jump into like a jumping jack. I mean, when you're mixing the two, that's funny, you know?
Zumba may be losing some of its Latin-inspired flavor. The company has recently expanded to include more international rhythms, from West Coast swing and belly dance to Bhangra and Bollywood. For NPR News, I'm Yoe Shaw.
And finally, a curtain call. You're at the theater, the last scene finishes, and the cast comes out for applause in reverse order of importance. It's all pretty standard today, but critic Bob Mondello remembers more elaborate curtain calls, and he misses them.
My first grown-up show, Oliver. Mom and me way up high in the upper balcony watching all those kids down below. One older character, Nancy, who looked a little like my mom, died in the second act, which I found pretty shocking. And at the curtain, it hadn't occurred to me yet that the actress hadn't died. So everybody else comes out for applause, reprising the songs they'd sung earlier, as was the custom, including little Oliver, who sang a song that Nancy had taught him earlier. Then he turned as the rest of the kids chimed in, sounding like a church choir, and they all looked up and sang the song directly to Nancy, who appeared in a spotlight, not down on the stage with everybody else, but way high up on a platform near the top of the proscenium arch, right in front of my second balcony seat. I was a smidge too old to think this was an actual miracle, and a bit too young to appreciate the stagecraft that made it all happen. All I knew was that Nancy was in heaven, and I was in tears. After that, I have to say, I expected something special from curtain calls. I don't anymore. They're just bows now, rarely as much fun as I remember from my youth, possibly because back then, standing ovations were not routine, so shows had to work for them. Sammy Davis Jr. doing part of his nightclub act after the cast went home to keep a lackluster musical running. Wouldn't happen today. The thing is, audiences love to go crazy. It means the tickets were worth it. In the 1960s, an experimental troupe got audiences to strip and join them for naked curtain calls. In the 1940s, crowds howled at the end of Arsenic and Old Lace when 12 guys who hadn't been in the show came out bowing. They were supposed to be the corpses buried in the cellar. And I remember one time, it was a costume change that triggered pandemonium. The Act with Liza Minnelli, terrible show in which she'd been all in Halston, silver, white, scarlet. Then at her bow, you realized there was one color you hadn't seen all night. As the spotlights hit her in a gown so emerald encrusted, she'd about dazzled her mom in Emerald City. Hit them, City. It was Liza in her prime, so the crowd would have stood anyway. But with that green dress, they stood and screamed.
Take me home now!
Actors may seem sincerely grateful for your applause at curtain calls, but they're performing. I found it moving the first time I saw Mame when Angela Lansbury had tears streaming down her face as the audience stood for her. 2 years and 800 performances later, when I saw her on tour and again the tears streamed, I wondered if she kept a raw onion backstage. Still, that's showbiz, as is applause, our chance to be part of the act. I had a theater professor who said that audiences clap not just to show that they like something, but also to let the performers know they understand it. Say an actor delivers a big diatribe and ends by stomping off stage, slamming a door behind him. When people applaud, they're saying, "We get it. The emotion's clear. The moment works." Same thing in a musical when a song has a big finish. As Wicked establishes again and again, end on a high note with an orchestral flourish, and you all but force an ovation. At a show's conclusion, as at a less flashy song, the audience will clap just out of politeness, but a smart director can give them one last thrill. I remember Yul Brynner touring in a bedraggled King and I toward the tail end of his career. The applause was tepid as the others smiled down front, but when it came Brynner's turn, he planted his feet wide at the back of the stage, crossed his arms in that kingly stance of his, and glared at the audience. It was a command. He was the king, and he wasn't coming forward until the audience stood. So, the audience stood. Could only work if you're Yul Brynner. So, is there a model curtain call? Well, conceptually, the one for a chorus line is pretty great, though in keeping with its "the group is everything" ethos, it doesn't allow for individual bows. Instead, the dancers who've been desperately auditioning all evening in rehearsal clothes dance on one by one in gold costumes and top hats, not bowing, but doing the big number they'd been so desperate to be anonymous in.
One singular sensation.
Individually singular, together they are a sensation, and as the curtain falls and the audience cheers, they're still kicking. It must be thrilling to be on the receiving end of applause. I'm guessing, of course, based on how good it feels to do the applauding, always leading the cheers, never getting them. That's a critic's lot in life. Though maybe my producer could arrange a little audio curtain call for my sign-off. Anything in the effects bank? Ugh. Polite applause. Total mood killer. That's more like it. Let me just bask for a moment. Love it. I'm Bob Mandela. Thank you. Thank you. Very kind. Please, it's too much. Thank you. Thank you. Thanks.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced this week by Sammy Yenigan and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.